From Washington, D.C., I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I review some of the comments we are hearing about Iran in Washington this week, as well as the implications of Benjamin Netanyahu's re-election in Israel.
This certainly isn't going to help the situation because the Obama administration, the Bush administration previously, have both been advancing this idea, and he now has taken a complete turn on that.
Later, my conversation with Texas A&M political scientist Mohammed Tabar. He argues Iran is actually one of the most pro-American countries in the Muslim world.
But what we see now, various political groups in Iran, including the president right now, would like to capitalize on this to improve relations with the U.S. for domestic gain.
International sources of Iran's domestic politics. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. Rebecca Cruz, we're in Washington, D.C. this week with students, and we've been having a lot of interesting meetings where Iran seems to be high on the agenda. We're hearing a lot of interesting feedback about the United States' relationship with Iran and concerns about the development of nuclear capabilities in Iran. So tell us a little bit about what we've been learning and what we should know about the ongoing negotiations between the United States, Iran, and several other countries as well.
Well, as you said, we've had the opportunity to visit Washington, D.C. and have been able to meet with the National Security Council, and that's obviously one of the top features on their agenda right now, as well as the Iranian interest section, which, of course, there are no formal relations between the United States and Iran, so this is a means for them to express their viewpoints here to the United States government, and obviously has been in the news quite a bit and has been a big topic of conversation. What we have learned, particularly about the negotiations that are ongoing and will be ongoing for some time. Perhaps we will see some resolution this summer, I think, is the time frame that we've been given. But we learned from the National Security Council, for example, that while the United States government is looking for a peaceful resolution here, that there are no things that are off the table, that all things are possible right now, though they do caution us that some sort of force being used is going to be destructive, and that obviously is the last choice. We have heard from the Iranian interest section, who obviously they were very upset by the letter that was sent last week from a number of senators, almost 50 senators that sent a letter. Some of them have retracted a bit, but this was very disturbing to them. And we've been reminded in several instances that this is an international effort, that the media really has taken this and looked at this as the United States and Iran, and certainly the senators that wrote the letter have been looking at this as the United States and Iran. But we're really talking about the P5 plus one. We're talking about the big countries plus Germany that are trying to negotiate this plan. It's not just about the United States and Iran and Israel, of course, being the other actor there that we've been hearing a lot about.
Of course, the P5 being the United States, Britain, France, China, Russia, and then, as you mentioned, Germany. Well, we also heard from one of the negotiators on Iran at one of our luncheon meetings this week, and she mentioned that, of course, military action would not eliminate the problem. It would make it worse, possibly. And if anything, it would just delay Iranian efforts to establish a nuclear capability. So, you know, everyone's preferring a diplomatic option. We were reminded that a military option remains on the table, but, these conversations are ongoing. The letter from the senators, of course, seem to perhaps, as many people have told us here in Washington, not necessarily help the situation. But let's transition from Iran to Israel. You know, let's just take in the region. Obviously, the other big news this week is the Israeli elections. Benjamin Netanyahu won again, and not only won again, he won big. And it was interesting how he did this and some of the things that he mentioned and he said leading up to the election. So, Rebecca, what are we to make of the impact that this is going to have?
Well, as you said, these two issues are related. Netanyahu was here in D.C. just a couple of weeks ago, which many viewed to be a political ploy because he was in a very tight election. In fact, just a couple of days ago, earlier this week, he was estimated to be losing in the polls, that he was not going to win re-election. And yet, when it really came down to it, he won handedly. And so obviously something happened. And what that something was is he seems to have embraced the right more than ever, and more specifically has said that he is no longer in favor of a two-state solution and appears to to be advancing more settlements or advancing the idea of more settlements, which of course have been very controversial. This drawing back on the idea of a separate Palestine really comes in the face of what the past couple of U.S. administrations have actually been advocating for. So we've talked on the show about the issues that Netanyahu and Obama are having, but this certainly isn't going to help the situation because the Obama administration, the Bush administration previously, have both been advancing this idea, and he now has taken a complete turn on that. So what this will do is it's going to be very interesting to see what this does. The United States and Israel are having a tough time right now, and I think that that relationship is going to continue to be strained. There's also some talk of sanctions against Israel. The EU, the United States, potentially putting on sanctions if settlements go forward. Others are arguing that perhaps that's what's needed, that some sort of external decision, external action is really going to be the only thing that pushes Israel to make a more positive decision in this regard.
Well, like you said, it'll be interesting to watch. We talk about these issues a lot. We are hearing from people here in Washington that that the re-election of Netanyahu may also help the Iranian negotiations and push the United States and the Europeans and others toward an agreement. So, you know, who knows? But very interesting international politics, as always. And so here from Washington, we're hearing about it every day. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being with me.
Thanks.
If you have any questions or comments for Rebecca or me, let us know on our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU and at Cruise226. You can see pictures of my Monday visit to NPR's headquarters in Washington on my Twitter account, at Suzette Gralat. Next, Texas A&M political scientist Mohammed Tabar joins me to discuss how international issues can affect Iran's internal domestic politics. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. This week, Secretary of State John Kerry met with his Iranian counterpart in Switzerland in the latest round of nuclear talks. My guest today says Iranian President Hassan Rouhani wants to use these talks to improve relations with the West. Texas A&M political scientist Mohammed Tabar spent his career researching Iran's domestic and foreign policy. He calls pro-American sentiment the major issue to use to gain domestic legitimacy in the Islamic Republic. Mohammed Tabar, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things I wanted to start with is your work that you've done on the international sources of Iran's domestic politics. And the reason why is that we often tend to think of countries, you know, really focusing first on the domestic sources in terms of the domestic pressures, right? So whether it's interest groups or certain, you know, public opinion or whatever it may be internal to the country that is having an impact on their position and the decisions that they're making, whether it's to obtain a nuclear weapons program or whatever it is. And in this case, you're arguing that there are external sources, international sources that are influencing what's going on in Iran. So first of all, just can you tell us what those sources are? What do you mean by that? And then what are the domestic consequences of those external or international sources?
Sure. In my research on Iran since the 79 revolution, I noticed that various political actors and factions and institutions in Iran often manipulate external issues for domestic gain. And it goes back, as I said, all the way to the 78-79 Islamic Revolution. And I give you one example. We often hear the 1979 hostage crisis in Iran, and which ended the Iran-U.S. relations. We often hear that that happened because of the 1953 coup. So it was a reaction that Iranian Islamist students had towards that 53 coup, as I said, the CIA-led coup in Iran. But the truth is that the Islamists at the time were afraid of the nationalists and the leftist groups. And in order to marginalize these both of their rivals, what they did was they decided to do the ultimate act, and that was to occupy the U.S. embassy. to capitalize on massive anti-American sentiment in Iran. Example number two, the Iran-Iraq War. There's no question that Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980. However, the clerical establishment in Iran at the time implicitly welcomed the war because they hadn't consolidated themselves yet. Partly through the hostage crisis, they could consolidate certain aspects of the regime, but not completely. So they used the Iran-Iraq War to make sure that the Iranian army and also the remnants of the nationalist and leftist groups were subdued or completely eradicated, so they could not pose a threat. Fast forward to today. If in the 70s and 80s, anti-Americanism was the capital, was the major issue to use to gain domestic legitimacy, now it's pro-Americanism. What's interesting in Iran is probably maybe one of the most pro-American nations in the Muslim world. Why? It's a different question. But what we see now, various political groups in Iran, including the president right now, would like to capitalize on this to improve relations with the U.S. for domestic gain.
So when you talk about domestic gain, I think I have two related questions here. One is, we often think about domestic political maneuverings to be in reaction to a diversion from something that's going on inside the country. So what you're describing here, reacting to or manipulating, as you say, external actors and external events and external sources in order to enhance some sort of domestic political gain, as you're referring to. Is that, an attempt to divert attention from something that's going on inside the country? Or is it just some way to consolidate power and to overcome rivalries and to engage in some sort of competition where somebody wins and somebody loses? Or is it maybe a little bit of both?
It is probably a little bit of both, but it's mostly, I would say, the second. So there is a competition right now between two political factions in the country. One is led by the Supreme Leader and the IRGC and other appointed institutions, and the second one is the president and others who are based on elected institutions. And based on these regional issues, based on these external issues, those domestic institutions will be empowered or will be undermined. So I give you one example. Right now, look at the situation in Syria. The Iranian Revolutionary Guards is heavily involved in Syria. They are backing Bashar al-Assad. A year ago, more than a year ago, when Bashar al-Assad was on the verge of collapse and a lot of people thought the U.S. was about to bomb Syria, all of a sudden there was a shift in the balance of power inside Iran. And the pragmatists, led by the president, were arguing that maybe Iran should not stick to Assad to the end. Maybe Iran should compromise. All of a sudden, when Bashar al-Assad agreed to dismantle his chemical arsenal, and Iran sent a lot of advisors to Syria to keep Assad in power, the balance of power shifted in Syria. So did in Iran. And you cannot overestimate how much Assad's survival impacted the confidence of the conservatives in Iran. And so if the Revolutionary Guards had a major success in Syria to keep Assad in charge, automatically they became much more powerful inside the country as well. So always those institutions that are involved outside, they achieve domestic gains. I'll give you a second example. When Iran managed to strike a deal on the nuclear issue with the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, and that was last November, all of a sudden Rouhani and his foreign minister Zarif and others, they became a lot more popular. And precisely because of that, the Supreme Leader and the IRGC became worried and they decided to slow down the nuclear negotiations process, which, again, we don't know whether or not it's going to succeed in the next couple of months, precisely because of the domestic consequences that the nuclear deal could have.
I'm speaking with Mohammed Tabar, a political scientist at Texas A&M University. We're talking about Iran's domestic politics, but through an international lens. More after a break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest today is Texas A&M political scientist Mohammed Tabar. Earlier, he called Iran one of the most pro-American nations in the Muslim world. So I have to to ask this. In your experience, when you are making these arguments, and I presume, you know, working with academics, but also policymakers, and presenting your findings and research regarding Iran's domestic political maneuverings, do you think that this often comes as a surprise to many decision makers over here? Because I have to think that we often tend to think of Iran and other countries too, but in this case, Iran, as a unitary actor, that there's this supreme Islamic state and that there is no domestic political, you know, separation of power and competition, but that they are unified on these issues like Syria or like the nuclear question. And so does this come as a surprise? Is that an obstacle to overcome to just help us understand those domestic political divisions in Iran and how we might be able to, for lack of a better term, exploit that to create a more favorable regime in Iran?
That's a really good and important question. So there are two different groups in Washington right now. One group that considers the Iranian government as a monolith, as you said. And they pretty much say it is a very conservative, fanatic regime, and the U.S. should pursue hawkish policies and undermine them and eventually change this regime. There is a second group, however, that does believe that there is a very dynamic faction of politics inside Iran. There are moderates and there are conservatives. And in this vicious domestic rivalry, there is so much that the U.S. can do to capitalize on or to exploit and to try to empower the moderates. I think the policy implication of my argument is this. The second group is right. However, the best way to exploit Iran's domestic politics, the best way to empower the moderates is not to do anything, is not to exploit it, is to treat Iran as a monolith. Because the moment you decide to empower the moderates in Iran, you make the other side nervous. And what the conservatives will do is automatically and quickly they try to derail any rapprochement or any negotiations or anything that would benefit the moderates. So the best way to support the moderates is not to support them.
This seems really counterintuitive, though, doesn't it?
And absolutely.
And don't policymakers push back a little bit on that
absolutely.
In terms of how to react?
Absolutely, they do. You're right. But the problem is we have seen this time and again. And by the way, this goes back to the 79 revolution. The U.S., there have been various groups in Washington who have appreciated the nuances of Iranian politics. However, their appreciation has been, as you said, counterintuitive and counterproductive because it has backfired. Every time the U.S., the Americans, or the Western government says so-and-so is a moderate president or a moderate group we should work with, this is the kiss of death, and it undermines them. However, the problem is, as you suggested, it is very difficult to make this issue institutionalized in Washington. There are people who either hate the government because it's a monolith and it is conservative, and there are others who would like to support the moderates. However, they don't, unfortunately, in practice.
Well, this makes for a very challenging foreign policy, right, in terms of how best to approach Iran. So let's go there and end on this subject of the U.S.-Iranian relationship and what we can expect in the future. I mean, there seem to be some signs of movement in terms of engagement, let's say, among at least lower-level decision-makers and officials. So what can we expect in the future? Do you expect that some of these domestic political changes might emerge where moderates might come out ahead of the extremists or not? And then how do you think this might affect ultimately the U.S.-Iranian relationship?
So after 8 years of President Ahmadinejad and all the consequences, all the domestic and regional consequences that his presidency had, there was a massive urge, not just on the part of the population, but even on the part of a lot of elites within the regime, that maybe there should be a more moderate president. The fruit of this was, or the silver lining of eight years of former President Ahmadinejad was that all of a sudden, in June 2013, the election was relatively free and fair by Iran's standards. And then we had a more pragmatic candidate who was able to win, and that was President Hassan Rouhani. President Rouhani ran on the platform of resolving Iran's nuclear issue. And within the first 100 days after he assumed office, He struck a deal with the P5 plus one, basically suspended certain aspects of Iran's nuclear program, and in return, no additional sanctions were imposed on Iran, and in fact, some sanctions were removed. His goal is to change this into a better relations with the world. And again, right after the nuclear deal last November, Iran improved its relations with the UK, and they were hoping to upgrade that into better relations with the US. And one of the things that happened after President Rouhani became president was he, for the first time ever, he spoke with an American president, with President Obama, and Iran's foreign minister has been meeting with Secretary of State John Kerry several times. So the taboo of Iran-US lack of negotiations between the two countries has been broken. And that has made President Rouhani very popular. And what he's hoping to do is there is going to be a very important, actually two important elections in Iran in 2016. One is the Assembly of Experts, which chooses the next supreme leader. The next one, the other one is the Majlis, the parliament in Iran. These are two very critical bodies, especially the second one. And he would like to use this nuclear issue to win elections next time and bring more pragmatists into these important critical bodies and eventually undermine the conservatives. Whether or not he's going to succeed, it remains to be seen.
But it sounds like there's some hope.
Absolutely. There is some hope. However, on the other hand, the other side is aware of this tactic, and they are doing everything they could to undermine this process.
Well, Mohammed, thank you so much for being here with us today to discuss that U.S.-Iran relationship. So thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with Mohammed Tabar, a political scientist at Texas A&M University who studies Iranian domestic and international politics. We have this conversation archived on our website, kgou.org. And while you're there, you can also subscribe to our podcast. It's also available on iTunes. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Our research fellow is Symphony Swift, Sam Dupre is our digital content intern, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolotte.